Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. I'm Eric Rubenstein, Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, Abuse, and I'm here with my two partners in crime, Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent charged from the LA field office and now one of our managers on our SIU investigative team, and Matt Kachansky, retired special agent charge from the HHS OIG and the retired Northeast UPIC director and now the director of our payment integrity team. So this week, we want to talk about something kind of interesting. For those of you that are podcasters that love to listen to podcasts in your day, we've got a great one. It's called Looking for the Toad, T-O-D-T Family. It's a podcast. You can get it on whatever platform you want. It's about 14 episodes, and it highlights a story involving a physical therapist by the name of Anthony Toad. And what makes this interesting is that he was a guy who was involved, a physical therapist in Connecticut, involved in a healthcare fraud case. And lo and behold, when HHS OIG agents went to go arrest him at his residence in Florida, we'll talk about why he was in Florida. Not only did they arrest Mr. Toad, but they found out that his wife, three children, and dog had been gruesomely murdered, to put it mildly. And so you have a healthcare fraud case and a murder case, maybe connected, maybe not connected. And so it presents some interesting things because the OIG agents were the ones that went into the house to arrest him and discovered this. You know, while I think that people generally think of healthcare fraud cases as being lower level white collar crimes, I don't think that's really the case. And we're going to talk about a few things. You know, I'll start off. I had a case involving a podiatrist in Jersey City. You can all look this up. Her name is Elaine Wittersheen. Elaine Wittersheen was a podiatrist who had a gambling and a drug problem. And at some point, she became the executor of her brother and sister-in-law's estate. The brother-in-law was a retired lieutenant from the Jersey City Police Department and died of alcohol-related issues. And so she was the executor and was managing the financial estate on behalf of the sister-in-law. But Elaine Wittersheen had a drug problem and a gambling problem herself. And what started off as a bad check case, basically check hiding, the Jersey City Police Department reached out to us at the OIG in New Jersey. And I was the agent that worked on that case. And what Ms. Wittersheen was doing was she was printing up her own checks. She was putting Medicare as the payor, but using her own bank account and routing number and bringing those checks to check cashing places in Jersey City. And while she was paying the fee, the checks were being processed and paid because it was basically her money. No one cares about what the name is on the payer. It's the routing and the account number. And after doing this three or four times, she would just go back and just put the money back in her account. And then ultimately she got herself about 50 grand because they had trusted her. She had a track record and got, you know, something like 50 grand. And, you know, ultimately we worked with the Jersey City Police Department to ensure that those checks weren't really Medicare checks and do all of that stuff. And she was arrested and she was on bond. Was supposed to be a part of an outpatient drug rehab program as part of her bail, failed to attend, and so she got remanded and was in an inpatient facility in Pennsylvania. While this was all going on, we were trying to do a little bit more investigation relative to the check cashing issue. At the time, this was still when computer forensics were still very young and very naive. And one of my collateral duties was to be what they called a seized computer evidence recovery specialist, or SCRS is what the name was. We went to the house. She lived with her then boyfriend. He gave us consent to take the computer. It was his computer that she had access to. And when we went back and looked at the computer, we discovered that she had been pilfering this money and doing all of these things. And then about a week later, we got a phone call that the sister-in-law's body showed up. It was in a cooler in the basement, and it was covered with lime, L-Y-M-E, which is a chemical that is used oftentimes to mask the smell of decomposing bodies. And the boyfriend was cleaning out the house, and allegedly, this was his story, he and a friend were allegedly carrying the cooler to the curb to throw it out. And as they were bringing the cooler to the curb, when they dropped it on the ground at the curb, an arm fell out of the cooler. And Miss Wittersheen's ultimate admission was that the sister-in-law was coming into the house to confront Miss Wittersheen about the theft, and she tripped on a concrete step on the way up, cracked her head open, and died. And Miss Wittersheen got nervous, thought she'd be accused of killing the sister-in-law, so she did that. The problem was that the sister-in-law had a huge hole in the front of her head that matched a hammer that was found in the house. So Miss Wittersheen brained the sister-in-law because she was going to be confronted with all of this. So, the point I'm making, and there have been other cases where OIG agents have worked on things that resulted in some of these other things. People have had threats on their lives for cases that they've worked, drug diversion cases, healthcare fraud cases. I had a threat at one point on one of the cases I worked involving someone. So it's not inordinately uncommon. And I think the point of this is that, oftentimes people will talk about HHS OIG agents, and the question is, well, you guys are just working healthcare cases. Why do you need guns? You always hear when there's a search warrant, oh, well, these guys showed up with guns. And yes, federal law enforcement agents, OIG agents, are part of the federal law enforcement criminal investigator job series, no different than FBI, DEA, ATF, or any of the other three-letter alphabet soups that are out there. And federal law enforcement agents like HHS OIG and other OIGs are trained to execute search warrants, conduct arrests, and the like. So it shouldn't be a surprise. What makes this case a little unique is, so Mr. Toad had an office in Connecticut, and at some point relocated his wife and three children to the Orlando area. He was living in a planned community that had originally been planned through Disney, a place called Celebration. They lived in a condo, and then vacated the condo, continued to own it, apparently pay a mortgage on it, and moved several blocks away to a house that they were paying about $5,000 a month in rent for. Mr. Toad had been under investigation for healthcare fraud on Medicaid, Medicare, and commercial for his physical therapy practice in Connecticut. He still flew back and forth each week from Connecticut to Florida and back, and operated his one practice in Florida during the weekends or part of the week, and his Connecticut practice part of the week. And it had been discovered during the investigation that he was billing for services not rendered. And one of the easiest ways to prove it is your travel records. If you're not in the place where the services are being rendered, it's very unlikely that you're able to perform services in multiple places. So for those of you that are into these podcasts, it's about a 14 episode Looking for the Toad Family is the name of it. Interestingly enough, there is a very, very heavy focus on the HHS OIG piece. There's not a lot of talk about the healthcare fraud, although it is discussed. There is a lot of discussion, obviously, about the murder of his wife and his three children, and ultimately his trial. And he takes the stand and his defense or his story. And I won't give any of that away. It's an interesting talk, but it is interesting because HHS OIG historically has not allowed agents to speak about investigations in any way, shape, or form. In this case, it appears the U.S. Attorney's Office in Connecticut actually dismissed the healthcare fraud charges in lieu of the fact that there was this murder conviction trial going on, or to that extent. So it is worth taking a read or a listen to, or reading articles about it. There's a ton of stuff out there about it. And it is interesting because HHS OIG made the initial discovery and was partly involved in the investigation that ensued. And for those who've never been involved with seeing those kinds of scenes, it can be gruesome. I spent 30 years as an EMT and a paramedic, and I worked for a couple of municipal services in my first life in a fire department and New York City EMS. And when I was in college, I worked for Buffalo EMS. Unfortunately, I guess I've seen a lot of bad things as a result. So I guess I'm a little more desensitized to some of that, but I could certainly relate to what our former coworkers would have encountered along that way. But the point is that there are going to be these instances where you're going to hear these crazy things that go on that would make you say that HHS OIG agents don't incessantly work just a white-collar healthcare fraud case. And you're all going to ask, how does this relate back to SIU operations? And we're going to get to that. But Wade, there's a great story that you tell. And when you and I did a retro fraud podcast, we talked about it a little bit. But if you can kind of just, a quick war story about the importance of things like operational planning, pre-operational planning, and kind of knowing your landscape about a very particular situation that some of your guys, when you were a supervisor, ran into in LA.
Yeah, I think it's important to talk a little bit about some of the things that we plan for the unknowns. So we kind of like try and do everything a little bit overkill. Things like having, doing drive-bys at a certain location you're going to go to. You can, see what vehicles are in the driveway. You can run the plates. You can do surveillance. We use vehicle trackers. There's a lot of different things we do to try and eliminate all these unknowns. But the case that you're talking about in general involved, without getting too much into the case itself, because that might take the whole podcast, but it was a case involving medical identity theft where a clinic administrator basically applied for a new Medicare provider number for a doctor that didn't know that he had done this. So, and this was before the electronic pay, so he was getting paper checks. And in order to cash those paper checks in someone else's name, he needed a money launderer. And this was where our informant came in. So he would bring us checks, batches of checks worth like around $100,000. And we had a source with another agency that we would actually cash these checks and give them the cash back. We'd take the checks, keep them for a couple of days, process them. So this one night we were doing exactly that. We were returning like $100,000 in cash to this clinic administrator. Again, not something you'd think would be high threat. The guy owns a clinic, but he's stealing a lot of money. And these types of cases, if you want to look at them this way, it's once they see what's happened and there's a search warrant or whatever, it's like the game is up. They have a lot to lose. Their lifestyle is going to change. They're probably going to do some prison time. But at any rate, on this night, we were returning some cash to this. It was supposed to be one person coming to meet with our informant. They show up, and there's about five different guys. We have audio and video cameras set up inside the informant's house. They come in and they have some conversations, and part of our MO was that we would hold the checks for a while to see what they were going to do, try and cash other checks elsewhere. So anyways, they're cashing these checks. The subject shows up with like five other guys, and we have some technical difficulties, which is pretty common, but they basically have to take the checks and go have someone else who's not there sign them because they're unsigned. So the story was they were going to leave and go to this whoever's house, irrelevant at this point, but to have the check signed. So when they leave, we go in to move the cameras because the cameras aren't working correctly and the audio is not working. We have somebody in the house. So we have him move the cameras to another area. And we, from our surveillance outside, we have like five cars with agents in them. We hear on the radio, they're back. They shouldn't be back for 20 minutes or so. About 5 minutes later, they come back. And I was just in the house with the tech agent, and I had just walked outside. So I drive away. The tech agent is stuck in the closet where he had just moved the cameras to. And now we have good video reception, and we can see that the five guys that they brought, at least two of them are armed. They have, pistols hanging off their hip. They brought to our informant, they brought body armor. And it kind of went from there, but the whole point is we weren't really expecting that type of an interaction. It was supposed to be a simple pay, but luckily we had like five cars there. We had a tech agent inside the house. We eventually had good audio and video. At first we didn't. It was terrible, so we had to move it, which kind of increased the issue, the problem there, because now we have somebody inside that wasn't there originally, but went in to move the camera and then got kind of stuck because they came back too early. But this goes back to the expect the unexpected and the unknown, because again, this should have been an easy 5-minute hand over the checks, hand over the cash, and be done with it. But it ended up being another hour and a half of just one thing after another where things weren't working, and then, you know, throwing wrenches into the machine. So again, back to where you really plan for the unexpected, because these types of things happen. And the fact that they were armed, and we had somebody now on the inside, again, if we were the auditors that didn't carry weapons, like back in the late, you know, early 90s, late 80s, it could have been, you know, a pretty bad situation. Although we did have 5 or 6 different agents, you know, within a block of the residence. But again, the unexpected happens, and that's why we have to go to these extreme measures to make sure we can address things that happen on the fly.
So, you know, at the end of the day, the issue is that you have to, you can account for as much as you can account for, right? And you can predict as much as you can predict. So you had as much as you could in your control as humanly possible, number of people, technology, all of that. But like anything else, there are things that are going to happen that you just don't, you know, readily recognize or are prepared to deal with, right? Yeah. Search warrants in a residence, for example, where there's children in the house that you don't expect. An arrest warrant where you show up. You know, I had this happen. I had an arrest warrant for a defendant, and I must have done surveillance on the defendant's house 20 times. Every single time I did surveillance, I knew he had 5 or 6 kids. Every time I did surveillance, the wife was home with the kids. 20, maybe more than 20 times in preparation for the search warrant and the arrest. The day we show up to do the search warrant and arrest is the one day the wife wasn't there. Why? She was a per diem nurse at a hospital and got called for an overnight shift. So when I went and put him to bed at 11 o'clock at night, the day before the search warrant, which is a common practice, is right, make sure the place that you're searching or arresting the next day, you make sure they're there. When I put him to bed at 11 o'clock at night, the night before, his car was in the driveway, the wife's car was in the driveway. Well, guess what? She worked at a hospital 15 minutes away. So she started her shift, because I asked him on the day that we arrested him, his wife had an 11:30 shift and she left the house at 11:15. And I left at 11 o'clock because I figured the lights were going out, everybody was going to bed. Well, everybody was going to bed, she was going to work. So we show up to arrest him and do our search warrant at, you know, 6:30 or 7 in the morning. We couldn't take him immediately without having to call Child Protective Services, which we didn't want to do because she was going to be home in a few minutes. So we had enough agents. And so we were able to at least corral him and the kids up until the wife showed up. But, right, expect the unexpected. And so you've got things that you can pre-operationally plan. I am sure that when the OIG agents on this particular case involving Anthony Tote went in the house, they did not expect to find what they found, and certainly were shocked by it as a result. But Matt, this kind of gets to this other piece, because it, you know, it doesn't really matter if you're an OIG agent, that's, you know, one piece of that puzzle. But, you know, in the SIU space, there are on-sites, right? We know when you were at the UPIC, you know, for those that aren't intimately familiar with UPICs, UPICs are essentially the Special Investigations Unit for Medicare. And so UPICs have investigators, non-law enforcement, although many that retire go and work for the UPICs, but you're no longer law enforcement. And the UPICs go out, SIUs go out and do on-sites. You know, we have a team here that does physical observations and things of that sort. But it is a piece of the puzzle that you have to try to account for and understand as much of that landscape as you can. Obviously, if someone has a body in their closet that's been sitting fermenting for a few weeks, you're not going to know that. But you obviously want to know as much as you can about where you're going and what you're doing. And SIUs tend to have a lot of background information from network agreements, applications, things of that sort, to kind of give you a flavor for where you're going and what you're doing.
Right. Even though, you know, they're not law enforcement, they're not the OIG, they don't have the resources of, you know, being able to pull up a poll camera or, you know, geo mapping on the, you know, on the geo navigator on the car, things like that. The on-sites are the closest thing that an SIU does that's akin to a search warrant, because you are going into someone else's space, you're interrupting their business, you are threatening their livelihood by, you know, going in there. You don't know what the reaction is going to be. So similar to law enforcement and what Wade said, you've got to take every precaution you can to gather as much information as you can about the place where you're going. You know, so some of the things you can do, you can geomap the place. You can just take a look on, you know, on geomap, you know, what does this place look like? Is it a storefront? Is it part of a, is it part of a, you know, a strip mall? Is it by itself? Is it a home? Is there easy entrance and egress? Try to gather as much as you can about the place itself. Try to learn about who's in there. Who are the providers of record in the data that you can see? Have you done any interviews of members? Who have they seen? What are their busiest days? So, you know, what day do you want to go into the place to minimize, you know, the interruption and the number of people that might be in there? Look to public databases like LexisNexis or Accurin to learn about property ownership. You know, with this guy, he was hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. There might be some lawsuits against him that are referenced in Accurin that could have given a clue as to maybe motive as to, you know, why was he doing the healthcare stuff and what kind of state of mind was he in during this point in time. Any information like that is very important. Drive-bys, you know, we can all do drive-bys. Take a look. What's the customer traffic? You know, what's, again, what is the entrance and the egress? You can do exclusion checks. You know, are any of these people excluded? Are licensing activities, have any come up against the licensing board for whatever reasons? Gather as much information as you can, because even though it's a regulatory action that you're taking and you're not law enforcement, once you're in that place, you can be seen as a threat to someone. Right. When I was with the UPIC, you know, we would do these. And in, you know, some of the neighborhoods of New York, to find out that these medical practices were associated, A, with each other, and B, with some sort of organized crime front. You know, we were met by the, you know, the shiny suits at the front, with the baleful stares, writing down our license plate numbers and all of those things. And in one instance, the chiropractor that we were interviewing, pulls us aside, takes us into the back and says, listen, I can't be seen talking to you because, as he said, the sausage makers are going to come in here to find out what I told you. So I can't say anything to you. And, you know, we left after 10 minutes. The next time we saw that guy, he had two broken hands. So you don't know what you're going to expect. And it does. And it's not just on onsites, you know, interviews. When I was at the NASA OIG, we did a simple interview of a college professor at the University of Alabama, Huntsville. It was on a grant fraud case. Didn't really have any legs. We were kind of just closing it out. We met with her. Things went fine. There was a little smoke, not a lot of fire. The next day, it somehow upset her because she had a tenure meeting with all the other members of her department. She shot and killed them all. You know, that could have been us the day before. You know, we didn't check, you know, NCIC on her, which we should have done, because we would have found out that she had been a suspect in a murder when she was a teenager, where she shot her brother. It was finally deemed accidental. But looking at the facts of the case, it wasn't accidental. Right. We should have known that. And that shows that the proper planning wasn't done in that instance, because it was just a routine interview.
Right. Yeah, a lot of that is, you know, a lot of that routine stuff becomes non-routine. I mean, you know, what's interesting is when the OIG agents in Connecticut, this was a Connecticut case, it really wasn't a Florida case, the healthcare fraud piece, when the agents executed the search warrant at his place of business, they interviewed him, And he admitted to committing the healthcare fraud. So that was like a home run. You know, you've got a full admission on doing it. And he was clearly living above his means. He had apparently purchased a very expensive water treadmill for hydrotherapy for knees and things of that sort. But, you know, you never really know. Most of the time, the issue isn't the people that you know. It's particularly when you go to a business, it's who's there that you don't know. What is the story of the people that you don't know that's creating that problem that you may have? But, you know, this was one of those cases where clearly this guy was living above his means. A condo that had a mortgage on it, a house he was renting for almost $5,000. Interviews with employees reflected that he was living above his means. Like, all of this kind of lent itself towards what that healthcare fraud piece of the puzzle is. But, you know, the other thing is what's the other issue? You know, I had a case towards the end of my career. I went to go serve a subpoena at a medical clinic in Newark. And while we were waiting for someone to come out to talk to them, an older guy came out and with a heavy Eastern European accent said, "You're Eric Rubenstein. I know you." And I didn't bat an eye. And I was like, "Oh, yeah?" And he said, "Yeah, you worked for," and he named my former supervisor and said, "You know, I helped him with many cases back in Brighton Beach in the day. I remember you from a search warrant." And he told me when it was, and the search warrant was literally 15 or 20 years earlier. And he remembered me from 15 or 20 years prior. If that doesn't send a chill down your spine, the fact that he remembered me from 20 years ago and it wasn't my case, I was just an agent on a search warrant. And the fact that this guy remembered who I was from 20 years ago, I was 20 years older, so I clearly didn't look necessarily the same. I was in Newark, New Jersey. The search warrant was in Brooklyn, so entirely different kind of geographic space. So a lot of it is not necessarily, you know, what you know, you know, who you know. It's sometimes that it's that unknown. And we spend a lot of time, we spend a lot of time with our SIU clients who do on-site work, trying to give them checklists and, you know, background information and what's out there publicly and, you know, and all of that. So Wade, I want to go to you, then I want to go to Matt as we kind of wrap up, you know, kind of a war story episode. What are your top three things from a pre-on-site planning perspective? What are the three things that you think are the most important? And then Matt, if Wade's hit those three, and you can come up with a couple of others because there's a huge list, but give me the three that kind of come to mind first.
Okay, so I guess the first one is get every detail you possibly can, even if you think it's not important. And Matt went over a lot of that stuff, whether it's LexisNexis, Accurint, you know, DMV, get DMV photos, that type of thing. Get all the information that's possible, even if you don't think it's relevant. I guess number two would be have more people than you think you're going to need. You really shouldn't be doing interviews solo, even if you think it's somebody who's just going to, you know, not be deceitful and answer questions. At a minimum for interviews, you should have two. If you're doing anything beyond interviews, get whoever's available. The more the merrier. Overkill is safety. And I guess three would be just be aware and expect unexpected things, such as, like, a lot of times in LA, we would go to do maybe just an interview and it's two people, but you're in a neighborhood where they see a Chevy Malibu pull up with tinted windows. Before you even get out of the car, they know you're an agent. And as you walk up to the door, you have people coming out, you know, looking to see. There might be some other thing completely unrelated going on next door, whether it be drugs or something. But when you walk up and you are out of place and you look like an agent, everybody in the neighborhood is noticing, and they're having calls to, you know, audible calls, like letting people know that there's agents in the area. So those are the, I guess, the three things: all the information you can get, as many people as you can get, and be aware that even if they're not concerned with what you're there for, they know that you're feds, and you should be aware of that and be
right,
you know, watching your six.
And that's sort of an important piece, because at the end of the day, nobody knew if we were OIG, DEA, FBI, NYPD. No one cares. You're just the you're just the police. It doesn't really matter. But, you know, part of that is from the SIU side is you're not an agent. You're not law enforcement, you know, and you should maybe think about not dressing like that or acting like that. Like, you know, it's how you tone it down. So, Matt, what are yours?
I mentioned before. Entrance and egress, you know, make sure that you're parking in a place that's accessible. If you need to get out, make sure that, you know, the amount of equipment that you're bringing with you can easily be carried in case you need to get out of a place. You know how, you know, the floor plan, you know how to get out as quickly as you can in case something happens, because it's more important. The first goal of any onsite, of any search warrant, of anything, is to get out safely. Evidence and all the information, secondary, get out safely. Secondly is roles and responsibilities. Make sure everybody understands exactly what they're supposed to be doing. Who's doing the interviews? Who's doing the medical review? Who's doing a tour of the facility? Who's taking pictures? Who's, you know, all of that stuff should be laid out beforehand, and you have a pre-briefing to go over their roles and responsibilities, as well as to go over all of the information that has been gathered about the place, so that everybody on the team starts with the same common knowledge. And then the third thing, you know, a little, you know, on the overkill side, know where the local hospital is, know how close it is, how quickly to get there, you know, and maybe perhaps even tell local police that you're going to be there. If you have, if you do that, if information gathering is kind of bringing up questions, you know, make sure that someone of an authority knows that you're there and why you're there.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, I'll wrap it up with one more stupid story, but the case with the guy who had all the kids, we were still conducting our interviews and stuff after the search warrant and his arrest. And I was in with another agent. We were at someone's house conducting an interview. No big deal. We were doing the interview. And in the middle of the interview, there was a knock on the door, and it was a local police officer from the town. Very small town in New Jersey. Everybody knew each other. And a lot of cops lived in the town, and there's a knock on the door, and the local cop says, the chief wants to have a conversation with you. Could you please follow me back to headquarters? Like, we're doing an interview. We'll come when we're done with the interview. And the local cop said, well, the chief wants to talk to you right now. Says, okay, well, when we're done with our interview, we'll come. And we got done, and we went to talk to the chief. And the chief said that he would have appreciated if we let him know that we were operating in his town. And I said, well, when we did the search warrant, we let you know. We're here doing follow-up interviews in the town. I'm not sure why you need to be notified. And it became a little bit of a discussion. And part of the discussion was, we don't know if anybody in the police department is intrinsically connected with anybody that's in this case. Like, how do we know if there's not people that are family or, you know, or what have you? And the chief then said, well, if you didn't want to talk to me, you could have talked to someone at the prosecutor's office or the state police or this. I said, you can go through a list of people that you think I should reach out to. But, you know, there's a little bit of a difference in that law enforcement perspective. Everybody from my office and my partner's office knew, his different agency knew. So, but that's a good point, Matt, is, you know, when you're there for an onsite as a private citizen, if you're an SIU, it may not be a bad idea to make a phone call when you're parked in the lot, not maybe days before, but kind of, you know, and call the non-emergency number and say, you know, I'm with the, you know, I'm an investigator with Medicare. We're going to be here doing an onsite. If anybody calls, just so you know. Don't be surprised if local police show up while you're doing the onsite because you've called them. They may show up to be like, what's going on here, and send a car over. That was not uncommon. It happened frequently. So, you know, some of these things you have to consider. And it's a little bit like that show on TV, expect the unexpected, because it's going to happen more often than you think. So, but, you know, listen, for those of you that are catching this podcast and you're seeing it through the LinkedIn link, what are your thoughts on this? What are your comments? If any of you have had any wacky things that have occurred from your SIU time, shoot us an email. Let us know. we're curious to hear what, you know, what's happened. So as always, great seeing you guys again. Weekly podcasts are coming out every Friday in the newsletter, Advise Health, ADVIZE, health.com. Catch it there. Catch our LinkedIn Live. You can catch our older podcasts on Spotify, YouTube, and the like. And definitely take a listen to this podcast. If you're a healthcare fraud person in any way, shape, or form, it's an interesting podcast to listen to, particularly because it really is discussing a different side of things that aren't an everyday occurrence in the OIG world. So it's a great podcast to listen to, and we hope we gave you some good food for thought on doing these on-site. So until next time, we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you all.